Welcome to The Perspectivalist. Our agenda is to offer a perspective of the world that allows you to think more clearly as a Christian. We want the normativity of scriptures to be the starting point of everything we do. So thanks for joining the conversation. This is Season 4, Episode 18, and I am your host, Yuri Brito. I have, over the years, have played the role as the international guest for hundreds of podcasts, so I feel very honored to have my British friend, Steve Jeffrey. And I've always said that the CREC needs a heavy dose of internationalism, primarily because they don't know much about soccer. And I think we need to really enculturate these Americans with what a true sport looks like. Steve, what do you think?
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Although, in fairness, we have a guy here in our church who is an extremely accomplished soccer player. He used to be semi-pro. And so we have one or two Americans around who could teach us a thing or two, but I still think the Brazilians probably could teach the world a thing or two about the beautiful game, don't you?
Well, I'm glad that there's a remnant.
I don't know about remnant. Maybe the culture of the beautiful game is gradually infusing the American
true.
South.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I often say that the churches look like their pastors, and if you wait long enough, the college football conversations will decrease and soccer will increase. And that's been the case here. In Pensacola.
Very good.
I want to talk about a host of things, but one of the things that's really transpired, and I want to talk about our denomination, the CREC. Mm-hmm. One of the things that has transpired in these last, since September of 2023, where we celebrate our 25th anniversary, is the visibility of our communion at large has just, I can't even put into words how much we have increased in attention. And it really is hard to fathom how a denomination that's as small as we are, with maybe 130 churches, has gotten that level of attention. And what we're seeing, of course, is this dramatic increase in numbers within our local churches. The interest is so significant. As you have been in the CREC for a few years, talk to me about what's happening, first of all, in Fort Worth, Texas, where you live, where I know the flock at All Saints has also grown. When you ask these individuals, Pastor Jeffrey, why are they coming to a CREC church? What's mm-hmm. the rationale behind it?
I think there's probably a number of different explanations, and I tend to be suspicious of monocausal explanations for things, but okay. There's a bunch of overlapping factors, and they include the increased visibility of the CREC in a social media context and online and in the culture more broadly. I think there's also something of a resurgence in covenantal reformed theology in many circles. And what that's doing is it's encouraging people to look for an expression of historic Christian faith that touches on the whole of life. And I think in the CREC, we are, we're nothing if not trying to do that. I think thirdly, there is the negative tragedy of many reformed churches and denominations and evangelical churches and denominations on which we used to be able to rely for faithful biblical witness that we can't any longer rely on. And it's really sad to say, but we are becoming a refuge for people who are fleeing woke churches or progressive churches. I think also there has been a realization that some of the modern fads and trends, especially in relation to worship style and worship content, weren't all that cracked up to be. I mean, the emerging or emergent church movement was great until it wasn't, you know? Yeah. And again, in the CREC, one of the things we've tried to do is to be spectacularly boring in the way that we order our worship, in the sense that we're trying to recover something that has been lost in the past. I remember when the church I had the privilege of leading from its inception in London, Emmanuel, from March 2009, I wanted to do some work on, you know, our order of worship before we started. And so I went back to a couple of old source books for Christian liturgies. And to my delight and astonishment, I found that more or less the structure of Christian worship didn't change for the first 1930 years of the church. You know, it all went crazy in about 1967. But more or less, the kind of covenant renewal style of worship that has been repopularized among us and is expounded in Jeff Meyer's book, The Lord's Service, is the kind of shape of Christian worship for centuries. And so people have found that enriching because it is enriching. And I think there's also, I mean, we've got to be honest, some of our churches in the CRC are growing more than others. And I think some of that is also to do with just broader demographic shifts. I mean, we're in Texas, and you see a fair number of California license plates around the place that for reasons which will be obvious to anybody. And so the effect around here is, or at All Saints, we've had the privilege of launching our first ever church plant from this congregation. Yeah. Let me give a quick plug for Christ Covenant Church in Granbury, Texas, which began last week. As we speak now, it's last Sunday, the 14th of January, pastored by Pastor Jeff Neal, who'd been a pastor here for many years. They began with 101 people. At their first service was about 150 people because they had visitors and family. And there was a baptism, and so some friends and family went to that. We have still got here 300 and plus something folks left behind, not in the left behind sense, but in, and if I look at that demographic, if I look at the church, the congregation here, and I mentioned this in a sermon a week or two ago, of those, it's about 300 and something people. 2/3 of those people have been here less than 3 years. So it's as though the church that remains here at All Saints has tripled in size in 3 years. And that is a wonderful gift. It brings with it some challenges, which would be obvious to any pastor and probably obvious to many in the congregations around. But I think those are some of the factors. And I guess I'll say one more thing, that behind it all, this is going to sound like it is making some grandiose claim for us as a church, but really it's not. Or as a communion, we have sought to remain faithful to the scriptures against various very strong secular tides that have become stronger in recent decades. And it's come to something when that should set us apart from other Reformed denominations. Now, it's not to criticize all other Reformed denominations, but it has to be said that just preaching and trying to live out ordinary, traditional, biblical Christian life has become a unique selling point. and that's really something when we get to that kind of state. So I don't know whether that's a more detailed answer than you were looking for, but as I look at it, those are some of the factors that I could identify.
No, that's very helpful. The element I wanted to add, just from thinking through these issues quite a bit, is obviously we experienced the COVID era, and there's a sense in which, as people are transitioning from that era, there are many churches that through the last 3 years didn't have much of an opportunity, for whatever reasons, to flex their liturgical muscles. And so that also included they didn't have an opportunity to tell and retell the narrative and the story of the scriptures. They didn't sing as much, and there was an incompletion in the way they did life as a body. And so it seems that as we are moving beyond those initial 3 years, that there are many of our CREC churches that were consistently, through various ways, flexing our muscles. We were meeting together in many ways. Some took a little bit of time off initially, but by and large, they were consistent throughout in saying there are habits and virtues and rituals of the Christian faith that we can't afford to not practice.
To relinquish.
And that has produced a level of consistency, stamina, and muscles that in many ways has attracted a lot of people who have come into our congregations, who may have seen videos online and said, look, we've heard of you guys for the first time, and we've heard of the culture that's existing here, but that has existed throughout the last 3 years. And that is an attractive feature. I don't know how things, the dynamic of our culture here in Pensacola, Steve, is that we have an inquirers class before as a prerequisite for membership. One of the questions we ask everyone is, what's been so attractive about Providence, Pensacola. And inevitably, someone will say something like, well, we have never been invited to someone's home. We didn't know that was a common practice. And in the first Sunday, we had to refuse three offers and accept a fourth because it was so overwhelming. And there is a sense in which the modern church, even before COVID, had lost the kind of vibrancy that identified the Christian faith for so long. And I think the CRC, in very small ways, are trying to restore these happy virtues.
No, I think you've really put your finger on something. And honestly, I mean, it's an easy thing to omit because I think we get so used to it. And certainly around here, it's been a blessing, which has become wonderfully familiar. But yeah, there are a number of people in the congregation here at All Saints who said, yeah, we've been looking around for a church and we went to a place, it was kind of hard to get to know people. And oh yeah, we showed up here and we fighting people off with a stick who are trying to invite us around to their place for dinner. And so that is wonderful. I was struck by this in Acts 5. I've been preaching through Acts, so All Saints folks will be familiar with this. But in Acts chapter 5, when Gamaliel adduces his famous Gamaliel test to the Sanhedrin about, you know, if leave these people alone, if it's of God, it will survive. You won't be able to oppose it. If it's not, it will fail. The test is actually not a doctrinal test. It's a test about, will this community endure? Will it be like Theudas and his followers, or Judas, who they gathered a few hundred people, then he died and everyone scattered? Or will it be a community that stays together and works and lives and loves together? And of course, that then segues straight into chapter 6, which is the disagreement between the two groups of widows about life in the community, which the church actually addresses and sorts out with the appointment of deacons. So again, what you've got is it is anticipated by Gamaliel that the thing that will mark out this community, if it's the real deal, is community life together, and actually particularly community meals, everyone being fed and enjoying that life together. I think that's probably emblematic of what of one of the things we should be striving for as we're seeking to embody genuine Christian culture in our churches.
Yeah, I think of, John Frame's tomes there in the back, his magnum opus. I think about these categories of normative, situational, and existential. And I think, in some ways, I think that's a summary of what we see in Acts 2:42. The people they're devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching, which would be the normative, the fellowship. I think you can, and to the breaking of bread and prayers. These things all fall within the contextual, historical nature of the church, and then the existential, which would be the people coming together and raising their petitions as one. But and I think these are the kinds of essential elements that, for some reason, evangelicalism has failed to incorporate. And I think what we're seeing, not just our churches, but in many others, is we're seeing pastors reassuming lost virtues or lost rituals that they didn't think were important. But what transpired during the 2020-2023 were the capacity of ministers and laity to see what really matters in their life as churchmen and as family people. And that has had the happy effect of causing them to really reconsider a lot of things. I mean, I know for a fact that there were people who weren't readers before COVID, and now they are delving into theological categories and these kinds of, in other words, the level of conversation I've noticed, Steve, just the level of conversation has grown a layer of substance in the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you something, because I wanted to probe that connection between our worship and our life as a community a little bit more deeply. A bit of background. So I released a couple of podcasts towards the end of last year, in which I addressed things like what we wear when we come to church and how we conduct ourselves during worship. And my conviction in talking about those things, there are two things. First, that worship matters in and of itself.
Yeah.
And also that how we worship God is going to shape how we live the rest of our lives. And I just love to hear you talk about those two things from your perspective. And I'll introduce it, what you say, by just saying I've been to the church where you pastor once or twice. And one of the things that's actually, you can probably hear some singing in the background. Can you hear that singing? I don't know where that's coming from on the recording. That's the school that meets in our church.
That's okay. Lovely.
But I've been to the church Providence in Pensacola where you pastor, Yuri. And if you sit in the front two-thirds of the church, you can hear you, Pastor Brito, singing. So what I've noticed is you have a very, almost not obsessively, but a single-mindedly, devotedly, energetic attention to the conduct of public worship. So can you talk about why that's important and how it shapes our lives as Christians and the rest of our life during the week?
Yes, my conviction has been for a very long time that the what the people of God do on the Lord's Day is going to overflow into whatever they do throughout the week. And so even the elements of worship themselves become symbols of what the people do, right? The tithing is very much connected to the economy of a people. And so the fellowship as well and all these things. And so I believe, Steve, that if worship is what I think the book of Hebrews says it is, which is in some ways worship is the merger of heaven and earth, is the enculturation of heaven in an earthly place, locale, a sacred space. If that's the case, then the things we do on Sunday mornings are going to overflow into the way we practice throughout the week. And one of the things I've always tried to emphasize when we talk about the subject of worship is that there is a lucidity to it that you don't have in any other human space. The Bible declares, our Reformed heritage sort of also speaks of this, that we are going to heavenly places. And so how does a heavenly people operate when they're gathered together as a whole? Well, there is encouragement, there's singing, there are physical postures that we have to abide by. There's kneeling, raising of hands, and all these things, what they do is they engage much more than our spiritual piety, but they also engage the human body itself. We are, after all, a corpus, and it engages the human body in a way that completely dismantles the level of worship equals segregation in the American evangelical world. Because worship is this blessed incorporation of body and soul, then that means that everyone is welcome to bring their bodies as living sacrifices, or as we say, as living liturgy unto God. Hmm. And so that the worship expression is indeed a very bodily expression. And when that comes together with a beautiful piety that allows us to grow in our sanctification, but also a manifestation of our bodies coming together as living sacrifices. I think to me, that's the heart of what we see in the book of Leviticus and the heart of what we see in the book of Revelation. When we have the people of God coming together, standing before the throne room of God and offering all that we have, body and soul, to God as a reasonable worship. And that's the kind of thing that becomes a pleasing aroma to God. And so the sobriety, I think, of worship is something that has to happen, and it happens. And the way that can be inculcated in the life of the people is by drawing the people into the liturgy itself. And that means that the best PR for All Saints and the best PR for Providence Church are almost always the little human beings that are running around the pews or the chairs. When dad and mom bring in their level of skepticism because they've read all sorts of strange things, when they bring their skepticism, it's usually the children who remove that skepticism. I mean, there's nothing more sobering and delightful than hearing parents come to us and say, I will never sing that version. I'll never sing Psalm 98 again. And then 3 weeks later, as their children have sort of blessed the home with hummings and different fragments of Psalm 98, the parents become the biggest apologist for the thing that you've been trying to do for a long time.
Right.
And I love that in everything that I've done here for the last 15, now 16 years,
yeah.
What I have, where in the early years, I had to put a lot of effort in communicating very succinctly and persuasively what I was trying to accomplish. Now, the things I want to do, I don't have just two or three witnesses behind me. I may have up to 300.
Right. And you've got all those young child witnesses who are so much quicker to catch on to what the Lord is doing sometimes than we are.
They really are. And, you know, and church in many ways for the people that are coming in, they are embracing that grammar stage of history,
right?
Which means absorbing, they're memorizing, and very soon they could easily sort of matriculate to the rhetoric stage, where they're the ones going out and doing the kinds of things that they never thought they would do.
Right. So let me ask another question then, which is related to that. This experience that we've had of lots of new people coming into our churches, and I realize many people will know this, but some may not. You serve now as the presiding minister of council. So as a representative of all of the presbyteries in the denomination to the outside world, and you speak on behalf of us and so on. So you have a picture of the denomination as a whole that most of us don't have. As you see that, you see these new people coming in. Is there a danger that we as pastors, or even some of the long-standing members of our churches, might take for granted some of the convictions that have shaped us over the years and neglect to pass them on to, so to speak, the next generation of CREC members? Do you perceive a danger there?
I think any denomination, if you look at here in the United States, the PCUSA, for example, which began as a really interesting experiment in, you know, sort of restoring a Calvinistic vision to the United States, you know, you can have very ambitious goals for a denomination in the early days. And then as it grows into its teenage years and then the 21, 25 years old, then that denomination is tested in whether they were able to maintain and preserve the things they wanted to do in the first few months and years of their tribe, or whether there's a trajectory of giving up little, sometimes minuscule little things. And in some ways, that's where we are right now. We're at that 25th year.
Yeah.
And we have become one of the reasons when I took this position, one of the things I really wanted to do was to find a way, using my visibility, to communicate the vision of what the founding members, those initial three churches, had in 1998. Yeah. And to realize that even though we've changed, I mean, we're talking through a means that they never imagined back in 1998, even though society has changed, technology has changed, crises have come and gone, the message remains the same. And so now it requires a certain level of orthodox adaptability that allow us to continue that vision, but also add a particular flavor to the CREC. And I know the CREC has never had a Brazilian flavor, but they're getting it now. And what I want to add with it is, I think, an enthusiasm for the cultural makeup of who we are, so that when our members in Pensacola, who have also, you know, our churches have had this happy student exchange program for a while, when our members go to All Saints, I want them to feel a unique flavor within the culture of hospitality. And when they come to Providence, they'll have a unique flavor, but with the culture of hospitality of Providence Church. But there's a continuity that exists that I think is the most remarkable thing. That if I go to Brazil this Sunday and I attend our little congregation there, if an American went there who's an attendee of a CREC church and he went to Brazil, he wouldn't understand the Portuguese being spoken, but he would feel the rhythm of a Nicene Creed, the rhythm of a Lord's Prayer. And that rhythm can transcend language, and we can sense at a very experiential level that there's a continuity of thought. And that's the kind of thing I want to see as we are being, in many ways, flooded by interest from CREC churches all over the world.
It's interesting. And it strikes me that, I mean, I nearly asked you the question, what would be the essential heart of the CREC's convictions. But I think you and I both know that we both love John Frame, and he's taught us that the best way to articulate any complex thing is from multiple perspectives simultaneously. And so the way that you've described there, the distinctive feature of the hospitality we're seeking to cultivate is an irreplaceable perspective on the whole. Maybe it's an existential, is an aspect of the existential perspective on what makes a CREC the CREC. And it strikes me that that, along with various normative and situational and other existential perspectives, need reaffirming. So just to take some glaring and obvious examples.
Yeah.
One of the things that was characteristic of our founding fathers, let's say, in the late 90s and early 2000s, was a recognition that Christian education of our children is so important that we ought to prioritize it, even if it becomes highly inconvenient to do so. And so it's much more convenient to send your kids to a government school, but really it's such a priority that giving our kids a Christ-centered education ought to be right at the top of our agenda for our families if we have children. Now, the exceptions, and of course we all know that there are exceptional circumstances, the exceptions go to prove the rule, because they exist only because of very, very unusual circumstances, which we wish didn't prevail, in other words. So there's that piece. There is the way that the covenant promises of God are made to his people and his people's children, and the way that family life ought to reflect that. There are convictions about theological matters, the confessional stance that we take, and so on and so forth. And I guess, so I'm not asking you to articulate what's the heart of the CREC, but rather, given those various perspectives, are there any that you think we should be particularly concerned to make sure that we articulate for the new generation of new CREC members?
Yes, I do. I do think so. My threefold sort of model, I think, as I move the CREC forward, are culture, theology, and liturgy. And I do think that the culture softens the hearts of people to be comfortable with our theology, and the theology softens the heart of our people to be comfortable with our liturgy. And I think that's the, I think as I've seen over the years, I think that's the trajectory. I do think, and I do want to borrow my friend Aaron Wren's sort of categories in these issues here. I do think he has something very right about his, he's got a new book that just came out, Living in the Negative World. Mm-hmm. There's something about what I call the Issacharian theology, though. You have to be the kinds of people who know the times, and that's you want to be those kinds of sons and daughters.
Yeah.
But as we look at the stage we're in right now, the kinds of questions that consume people at every level today are, in many ways, are the political motifs of society, because we're so bombarded by these things. Mm-hmm. And I think pastors have to be, there was a tendency within Presbyterianism, even when I was in seminary, that the pastor simply said what the Word of God said, and they allowed the Holy Spirit to make the applications, what they call the redemptive model of preaching.
Yeah, we all remember that.
I don't subscribe to that.
Huh? We all remember being told that.
Yes, yes. Obviously, we're both Framians in our approach. We decry that model. But I think even the pastors who were somewhat suspicious of the kind of Framian approach, today they are saying,
right,
no, perhaps there are certain political applications. I mean, because the Bible overall, if the church is this alternative city, and if this alternative city has a king, mm-hmm. and if when this king is born, he is named after every conceivable political title.
Yes.
One of our Christmas carols refers to Jesus as the monarch of all. And then my favorite Christmas carols that's not sung very well begins by saying, "This little babe, so few days old, has come to rifle Satan's fold." And so all these things imply a political title. He is Lord, he is King. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, then there ought to be a careful politicization of the scriptures that applies to issues regarding woke ideology, leftism, socialism, which is the kind of stuff we're experiencing right now in South America, and other political concerns as well. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, I think we live in the negative world, and the negative world thinks we're insane. And what we try to do in our preaching and in our communion, in some ways, is to teach the world that there is a way to live politically sane mm-hmm. when the world has gone insane. And that takes us back, of course, to that the greatest of political acts is the act of worship. That is the most fundamental. Even the pugilistic and cranky Gary North said in the 1980s that his famous line was "politics fourth."
Yeah,
you know. So that there are fundamental things. Yes.
What was it after worship? Two other things. I forget what the other worship evangelism wasn't that one of the other things.
Yeah, I think it was evangelism and
family life or something. I can't remember. Yeah,
the third one was sort of the economy of the family.
Yeah.
And so we need to keep these things in perspective, realizing that the very acts that the world considers to be non-offensive, non-threatening, are indeed the way that the church conquers the political realm, you know?
Yes.
And so the danger, of course, is that as we become sort of headquarters for the GOP, we don't want that, but we do want our people leaving church on Sunday morning saying there is a fundamental creational dimension to life that we must honor in order to live and to provide a kind of society that's worth living for our children and grandchildren.
No, I think you're right. And one of the mistakes I think that we make when we start thinking about politics in the most broad sense, that is the formation of civilization, communities of people, is we falsely imagine that secular civil government politics is the only game in town. Like the only community that matters is the community that we're told about or that is imposed upon us by the non-existent social contract or whatever. And to say, no, the church is a political community with its own rituals, its own way of life, its own rules, its own norms, its own way of relating to other powers that have real delegated, Christ delegated authority. And we're doing politics in the sense of living in a world where we're trying to shape larger structures of communal life. We're doing that in worship. We're doing that as we gather around a single table for our meal. We're doing it as we seek to build relationships within our congregations and to people adjacent to them. And then what you discover is that actually starts gradually to impinge on spheres outside the church. Mm-hmm. But it begins by insisting that, I can't remember who said, maybe it was even Peter Lighthart, worldly politics is not the only game in town. Mm-hmm. Worldly unity is not the only game in town. The way that the community of the church conducts itself is an illustration I grabbed thin air recently. Well, not really out of thin air, more out of 1 Corinthians 15. The church is this seed that has been planted in the ground mm-hmm. in Christ to grow into something to fill the world. And it's that seed that is growing.
It's growing, and I think we have a history has provided this trajectory for us, you know, from 12 disciples to Constantine to the Reformation to where we are today, that if we view the civil government as the only place where true community is found, civil government is going to provide for you a temporary sense of unity, but it is the greatest form of tribalism. And only one institution has declared very boldly, there's neither Jew nor Greek, male or female, slave or free, right? But but in the civil structure, those hierarchies exist continually. And the hierarchy of the church is different because it's a unifying hierarchy. Jesus is bringing together heaven and earth under image bearers, and he's using us as spokesmen for for the cause of the kingdom. And also, and the final thing, of course, is that, you know, out of all human institutions, out of all institutions created, only one survives into eternity.
Right.
And so, right. And that's hard for a lot of people to grasp, that the familial structures and the civil government structures will fade into oblivion, but the church of the Lord will remain forever, because the gates of hell shall not prevail against the church. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be very cautious that the church continues having that first voice. That's the best way to phrase it. The church has
like
the first voice. It doesn't mean there can't be other voices, but the church must speak because her husband has spoken into the world and created the world.
Yeah. Yuri, that's wonderful to hear. I'm conscious that this is going out on your podcast, but you know that you're going out on ours here at All Saints. I wonder if I could ask you to give a final brief word to the congregation here. We got 300 and something people plus 100 and something down in Granbury who are excited to be here, thrilled to be part of the denomination that we're both in. And you're the presiding minister, brother. Do you have a word of encouragement or exhortation for the saints here in Fort Worth and Granbury?
Yes. Well, first and foremost, I want the saints there at All Saints to know that we hear of, as John says in 2 John, we hear of your faith. We hear that you are walking in truth and in love. And that's encouraging. We have, you know, our little ambassadors that go to Texas and come back and bring good tidings of great joy from All Saints. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that there is, and you mentioned this, I think, earlier, there is a glory to sameness that I think every member needs to keep in mind. And the glory of sameness is that when we gather for worship, God is forming us and making us better humans. And so part of the alliance and part of the vows we make to our local churches is that sameness is creating us and is doing something marvelous. And the nature of the experience we have when we come together, that thing needs to be worked on consistently and continually. That the members of All Saints, like the members of Providence, are going to go through phases where they may be tempted to think, oh, you know, the church is not as important this week, and the church is not as important for the next 2 weeks. And what that creates is a sense of independence, or a sense of dependence on your own way to bring about a particular happiness,
right.
Which we have seen as pastors, it does not accomplish that. Yeah. And so my exhortation to the saints of All Saints is that when you are tempted to view the church as secondary, and when you are perhaps grieving or going through a hard situation where there are family tumult or family difficulties within the church, know that that is part of the DNA of any church life. And that now, because you have detected that there is an inconsistency of life, that everything is not as green as you thought it would be, it's that point where your church membership is tested.
Right.
So that your church membership is given for such a time as this. And that's at that point where you need to be an agent of reconciliation, an agent of peace. And what you will see the longer you are at All Saints is that when you have walked through that history, what that's forming is a purer tapestry, because that tapestry is not just composed of happy moments, but it's composed of the life that we experience annually in the church calendar. It's composed of Lenten moments. It's composed of Advental moments. And then ultimately, it's composed of Easter moments. So that's my encouragement to the saints there in Texas.
Pastor Yuri Brito, Providence Church in Pensacola, presiding minister of council of the CREC. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you on, albeit for this short time today. We hope that if you're ever passing through this part of Texas, you will stop off and spend some time with us. And let me say, it's been a pleasure for me also just to hang out with you and to appear on, how do I say it? The Perspectivalist.
Perspectivalist.
How should I say that?
I am a product of my teachers, and I have such a great affection for John Frame, and I love the way he thinks about the world, because I think he thinks in a very pastoral way, and that's my honor to my professor.
This is a conversation we should have another time, but I think that in a couple of hundred years' time, our successors will look back on John Frame, who's still alive and still writing, as a great Reformed theologian in the line of Calvin, Barvink, and others. All right, brother, I should let you go. The Lord bless you. Bye for now. All right.
Lord bless you, my friend.